Hello and welcome back to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. The title comes from one of the more well-known events in Jesus' life, when he gets asked if a devout Jew should pay taxes to Rome. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and unto God what is God's." Today we hear from Dr. Bridget Kahl, a German biblical scholar who unpacks the life of the Apostle Paul. She claims that new insights into his life and writings may reveal just how much the greatest Christian missionary has been misunderstood. But before we get to the interview, here's a little bit about Dr. Kahl, though she prefers to be called Bridget. Bridget Kahl teaches New Testament and Bible at Union Theological Seminary in New York. A native of East Germany and a Lutheran by birth, she was ordained in the Protestant Church of Berlin-Brandenburg. She graduated from Humboldt University in Berlin, where she taught ecumenical Bible studies and New Testament until moving to the U.S. in 1998. A major focus of her work has been on critically recontextualizing Paul and Lutheran justification theology within the framework of the Roman Empire. Her book, called Galatians Reimagined, Reading with the Eyes of the Vanquished, was published in 2010 with Fortress Press. Bridget starts our interview by talking about her background and how her upbringing influences her work up to this day. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope that you get as much out of hearing from Bridget as I did.
My trajectory is different from others in that I'm coming from the East, from Eastern Europe. So I'm not a German, but an East German by birth. So I grew up in East Germany behind the Iron Curtain. And I stayed there until 1989 when the world changed and the wall fell. So and now I'm back in a country where walls are built again, you know, passionately. And that is very, very kind of problematic for me.
This was a bit of a play on the whole Donald Trump presidency.
But, well, that aside, so I studied theology in East Germany, and that is interesting for many people because they wouldn't believe that something like that existed in East Germany. Mm-hmm. And I moved to the United States in 1998. That is, I've been there for 25 years. And but I bring different perspectives to the way how I do theology. So that is maybe the thing that you might mention or need to know.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And what has been kind of your journey with Christianity? Is it something you grew up with, or how did what's your relationship that way?
Well, I grew up as a Lutheran Christian in an atheist country that was I would not say militant. There was no militant atheism, but you know, atheism was state ideology, and Christianity was not much liked. So that has shaped my experience with Christianity as a tiny minority in a country that had a very different ideology and tried to get rid of Christianity. So Christianity for me had to do something with resistance, but also after a while I came to understand that, you know, the values of socialism are not so far away from Christianity. And so Christianity and the Bible for me, they're always a way of also challenging the way socialism functioned in East Germany or was practiced in East Germany. And I think it wasn't even proper socialism yet, but it was something that was distorted for many reasons. It grew out of a terrible war, and it grew out of poverty, and you know, we could talk, but that would be a different interview. But you know, my Christianity is not, you know, the normative German Christianity, but it is a Christianity that came out of a specific context that had a lot to do with with politics, because being a Christian was political in East Germany, no matter what. And also with, envisioning society to function differently. Mm-hmm. And then we learned a lot in East Germany was the place that was very open to third world, people from the third world. And they taught me a lot about how they understood socialism and societal change. And that was that something I brought over to the United States and could apply it in a different context, but it fit astonishingly well there as well.
So that's interesting. So were your parents then pretty strong Lutherans, or like, did you grow up with that kind of upbringing, or yeah?
Well, I grew up in the, you know, in the birth country of Martin Luther. So East Germany had Martin Luther. So Wittenberg and the Wartburg, all these places are in East Germany. So and I was my birthplace is Saxony, and Saxony, Leipzig, Dresden. I come from Chemnitz, which was later renamed into Karl-Marx-Stadt. So these are all places where Luther is very much present. So yes, I grew up in a pretty arch conservative Lutheranism that I then also challenged very much, because it was not up to, I think, what we needed in that situation.
Mm. That's fascinating. I was going to tell you, Bridget, I've been to Germany a few times, but years ago I was very, I was quite entrenched in, I would say, more charismatic Christianity. And I actually went to Herrnhut in Germany.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes.
Yes, because I had this fascination with Ludwig von Zinzendorf.
Yes.
And it was very interesting, you know, that's a community that not many people know about. But of course, you had to pass through Dresden to get there on a train.
Yes.
And but yeah, there's some real interesting history in that that part of the world that I don't think many people know about, in terms of the whole Moravian church. It's a fascinating history to me, you know.
This was actually a trip I took in 2001. I'd been living in Czech Republic, and I took a side trip to Germany because I was fascinated by this, and I was involved with a movement called the 24/7 prayer movement. And yeah, I took this train trip out to past Dresden to a small town called Herrnhut, and it was actually the scene of a revival and the birth of the Moravian Church, and in association with German nobleman named Ludwig von Zinzendorf. Pretty interesting history. Haven't thought about it in years, but talked about it a bit here with Bridget.
Yeah, and it is a strand of this different tradition of Christianity that never was the dominant one. But I think this different strand of tradition preserved much of the original Christianity. So that got lost in dominant Christianities.
Yeah, and I liked her point here, because it's that's why I think I was so fascinated with the Moravian Church, because there really seemed to be almost this. This capsule, this time capsule of the early church, and this would have been around 1700s-ish in Germany that the Moravian Church really developed and then spread missionaries all over the world, but definitely was not a part of the dominant Christian movement at the time.
Yeah, well, so coming to the question of Paul, what's... Can you take me through this relationship with Paul in your life? This character in the New Testament that's a very larger in life character. But how? Where did that all begin for you in understanding, trying to understand who Paul was?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, if you know that I'm a Luther. You have, you understand, my Paul was always a challenge to me because the way he was interpreted in my church at my time didn't make sense to me as a child. You know, this justification theology, that was the way I learned it, was very detached from life and from what we do, you know, no works but faith and forgiveness of sins. And so that was like a very, like living in a vacuum of, you know, of faith realities that I never really knew how to connect to the challenges I was facing in real life. Mm-hmm. And that's why I, you know, I started to work on Paul almost automatically. And you know, and I just wanted to figure him out for myself. So I wanted to understand what was it that was driving him into these complex theological statements that I really never really understood fully.
When you said some of these situations that you were in, that at least what I heard you say is that made understanding Paul confusing, given what you were hearing in the pulpit. I don't know if you follow me, but do you have an example of a situation or a context that you were in where what you were hearing about Paul and what you were living just weren't lining up? Does that make sense?
Oh, that's interesting. That is interesting. Well, I don't have the exact example for this question. I would need to think more about it. It definitely exists, but it doesn't come to my mind. But you know, my parents raised me as, you know, you have to put up resistance against the atheist state. And that meant, for example, that you have to in at school you have to say, oh, I don't participate in that, I don't do this. So it was always a little bit a complicated situation, but you know, it taught me a lot also in terms of, you know, you have to stand up for things. But So atheism was bad, and you know, believing in God was the good thing to do. And but then I, at some point, this got, you know, messed up, this clear dichotomy, because I understood people, and these are people from the third world. So I, for a long time, I worked as a translator. I translated in ecumenical meetings, and I was still very young. And you know, I learned. You know, I translated, but I learned. And these people talked about God, God being, you know, it doesn't matter that we say, oh, I believe in God, but the question is, which God do you believe in? What does God mean for you? And then does God justify systems of oppression, of injustice, or does this God stand against that? Does this God, you know, stand with the people who fight for their justice? And then that was the point when, for me, this clicked in. Justice and justification, you know, justification by faith, the big Lutheran dogmatic formula. And then has it anything to do with justice? Or is it just like something in a different world, you know, justification, that what happens to the individual in their relation to God, and it has nothing to do with relations among humans, you know, in society and even among nations or whatever. So this is the lesson I learned by just listening to people from the third world, from Nicaragua, and from, you know, who came and talked about their experience, and also talked about the Christianities that they have been, you know, they have been taught, and that had, you know, been brought by the missionaries, by the European missionaries, who brought them a god who was very much on the side of the dominant powers. And then they had discovered this different god who stood on their side. So that was, these were the, my big, you know, the process, a long process of, you know, conscientization. I mean, you know, the, this is the kind of a word from liberation theology, that, that your mind changes and you conceive God differently. And that started already in East Germany. And it was, you know, this was the time of the, it was the 60s, you know, the Second Vatican Council. The Catholic Church changes profoundly. And then the Ecumenical Council of Churches, the Protestant counterpart, changes too. So they start the program to combat racism. The Ecumenical Council of Churches, the WCC, and they liberation theology starts to emerge in Latin America. The bishops draft a different theology. Martin Luther King here in the United States preaches, you know, it's not just justice for black people, but, you know, for people of all colors who are oppressed, and even people in Vietnam, you know, and this was the point when he got murdered, you know, this was dangerous. Justice for black people was dangerous enough, but connecting justice for black people with justice for poor people of all colors, and for even for people outside the country who are, you know, bombed with Agent Orange and napalm. And
from my understanding, actually, it was on this point when Martin Luther King Jr. gave his speech about Vietnam, and it was then that he actually sidelined some different activists who had been with him on civil rights. They were questioning, why are you pressing on this issue of Vietnam? And some people believe that's really what resulted in him getting killed, was his basically looking at the American Empire and what it was doing overseas, and how blacks were fighting in the army for rights they didn't even have in their own country.
And, you know, poor Vietnamese farmers. So, and bring that all together, that was too dangerous. That got him killed. And so it took me a while. That took many decades, I mean, like almost 3 decades, until I understood that this, what Martin Luther King had said at, you know, in the 60s, and what I only at that time remotely took in, that was Pauline. That was the real Paul for me. That was what Paul had in mind. And I stumbled across a film project that Pasolini wanted to do, you know, the big filmmaker, the famous filmmaker. He wanted to do a movie on Paul. And he had said that the final scene when Paul gets killed in New York, that is the new Rome for him. And the place where he gets killed is a balcony that Pasolini wanted to look exactly like the balcony where Martin Luther King was shot. Oh. So he got it exactly right. So he understood, and I noticed that people outside the church understood Paul often better than the church themselves.
I did a little digging into Pier Paolo Pasolini. He's an Italian film director. He had a famous film which documented the life of Jesus, and it was called The Gospel According to Matthew. And it's interesting, he actually was an atheist. And I think this is what Bridget was talking about when she said, you know, people from outside the church are able to really grasp the life of Paul and what it would mean in contemporary society. He actually wrote a script for a film, and it never got made. So to all you budding filmmakers out there, here you go. This would be a great story to continue.
That takes me right to the question of, why do you think Paul has been so misunderstood in the church?
Well, you know, this is a tricky question. I'm not here sitting and saying, you know, I have the right understanding of Paul. You know, this is always, we have to be aware that these are texts that are 2,000 years old, you know, and we have to understand the enormous distance. And, you know, before we drag him so easily, what we always do, we take him as one of us. But I think we have to start understanding that he is living in a very different context, and that we have to acknowledge and respect that difference. So I'm not saying here I have the perfect and the true understanding of Paul, because I think this always can lead down a very slippery slope when you say I am the one who has to got it right. But what I think is, I think I have found an understanding of Paul that makes much more sense historically, and also, which is always important for the way how, I mean, something that makes sense to us. You know, of course, we don't want a Paul that we just make up so that he fits into our plans. But I think scripture still has some rules and some criteria that we can apply in order to make a case that this image of Paul is more plausible, or it is also much needed today, because the old image of Paul leads us into very, keeps us captive in patterns of thought that are no longer helpful at all. So, yeah, and why has he been misunderstood? I mean, so the whole history of interpretation, you can say, is a constant history of try and error, you know, you could say that it is, I mean, Paul has been misunderstood in his history of interpretation, and the misunderstandings have been handed down diligently, and you have whole libraries there where misunderstanding reproduces more misunderstanding and so on. Yeah. And so
I'm just curious, in another episode of this program, I brought up the point and with a speaker of just how we've entered this age where because of the advances in scholarship, there's, in some ways, we can understand more about the Bible today than we almost ever could. That brings me to the question, what is the recent scholarship saying about Paul's writings? You know, because one thing that I know blew my mind, Bridget, was just a couple months ago reading somewhere, oh, well, some of Paul's writings were pretty sure are authentic, and others were not sure if exactly are him. And then some were no, for sure they're not him. And I was like, what? No one has ever. And then I read it in a couple other places from other scholars. And I thought, why? I mean, this is kind of another question almost. Why isn't this ever talked about in churches or anything like that? Uh-huh. So I guess that's two questions. Like, what is this recent scholarship saying about Paul? Because, you know I would get confused, you know, reading about no Gentile or Jew, no male or female, no slave or free, all are one in Christ. And then women, be quiet and submit and don't say anything. And I was like, what is this guy, schizophrenic? Or is he like, who is this guy? You know? I guess that's my one question. And then the other is, why isn't that trickling down into our pews, you know?
I hope people aren't offended by me calling Paul a possible schizophrenic. My intention was just to point out that there's some different voices coming from the same author. Bridget takes that on here now.
I mean, maybe we start with the last question, because that is shorter to answer. I think institutions have something like an inertia that, you know, in physics, you have inertia. That is the natural resistance of of masses of bodies to against motion, against anything that sets them in motion. So we want things to stay as they are. But you know, that is the opposite of really what propels Paul and what propels the New Testament. This is a movement, something getting started to changing an existing institution, a societal, but also what we today would say a church institution. So the people of the New Testament really tried to change everything and or move into a different direction. And we use these texts in order, you know, to make an argument that we can stay as we are. So this is a kind of a big contradiction. And then, of course, with Paul, it is something special because he basically makes the connective tissue of all our dogmatics, especially conservative dogmatics. And you can really almost, that is a denominational qualifier. If you ask people whom they quote most, so the people, the more progressive liberal leaning people tend to quote Paul, Jesus and the Gospels. And the more conservative leaning, you know, base themselves on Paul almost exclusively. So that's why liberation theology did more Jesus than Paul. And that's why I thought it's so important to, you know, to understand whether Paul is also can be, you know, regained for a new type of theology, because he is the bedrock of conservative theology. I mean, there's no doubt. And now what you quote, that is, you know, it's not that, this is very interesting that even the most basic and fundamental insights of scholarship don't trickle down into churches. And I don't understand how this happens. I really don't. But there is this resistance against change. I really think, and also what we are missing more and more, although that's, I think, applies even more to the progressives and liberals, we are no longer reading Bible. We are no longer actively engaging these texts. Either we read them and we just get out of them what we already knew, or we don't read them at all because we think they are too conservative, right? So I think we need to regain a culture of active engagement of scripture. So that's missing everywhere.
Hello, folks, and thanks for listening to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. If you're just joining us now, I'm chatting with theologian Bridget Call about the Apostle Paul and the importance of regaining a culture of active scripture engagement. Bridget just talked about how this is really lacking on both sides of the political spectrum. On one extreme, you have progressives who too easily dismiss the Bible as archaic and conservative. And on the other hand, you have conservatives whose lack of engagement with biblical culture and context results in them further entrenching themselves in their preconceived notions. I found her analysis of this very astute and poignant. Please stick around as I ask Bridget to talk more about Paul's New Testament writings and why some of them are considered authentic while others are not. Thanks for listening.
You are mentioning that there are seven genuine letters and authentic letters of Paul that we pretty much are sure that are written by him. And then there are others who are, well, we can be pretty sure not written by him, because they are very different in style, in the whole way, in rhetoric and the language that is used and so on. So there are some ways to categorize texts and say, well, this text was not written by this author. And in antiquity, this was done all the time. You know, you quote, you take the pen name of somebody and write under his name. And that is not forgery in antiquity. This is just like a very standard practice. You want to, you know, you want to, it's something like you preach on that person and you say what the person would say today. And you are sure you have the right way to talk in this person's name. So that is very familiar, very kind of standard. And but, you know, that means also that the person who speaks in the name of somebody else, like the letter of Timothy or Titus, the pastoral letters, they say something else, really, than what Paul has said. They speak in a different time.
So Timothy and Titus are two of the letters of Paul that a growing number of scholars have said are probably not authentic Pauline letters, but written by someone else using Paul's name.
They speak, you know, 40 years after Paul, and things have changed since then. And but, you know, it's interesting, and they come up with some very conservative patterns. And these patterns have been, you know, pronounced as the real Paul. That was became the Pauline paradigm. And everything else has been read through the lens of this paradigm, everything else in Paul. And this is the wrong way around. So we have to read Paul from his real letters, Romans, Galatians, Philippians, Corinthians, Philemon. So that is the seven genuine letters. And we cannot read him through the lens of Acts, the Acts of Apostles, 30 years after him, a very different, you know, a very different notion of who Paul is, nor through the lens of the pastoral letters. That then there is disputed whether Ephesians and Colossians are written by Paul. You can go either way with that. I'm not a fanatic on that, but I think we just have to understand that the Bible brings Paul in different versions. And we cannot just say there is one version. I mean, we have to understand that each Pauline voice talks differently.
It's fascinating, Bridget. Just coming to that point, two questions, but this whole understanding of differences in some of Paul's letters and whether it really was his authorship, I guess my one question is this a broadly accepted concept among biblical scholars now? And secondly, could you take us a bit into some of those criteria that scholars have identified that help determine what is authentic Paul and what isn't authentic Paul?
Well, I mean, that would require a whole lecture. It's interesting. It is acknowledged in scholarship. I don't know, you know, that is, you know, I don't know, you know, how it is in evangelical scholarship. That is, that is something I should explore. I don't actually know. But, you know, the standard, there is something like standard scholarship that I think, yeah. But I don't say that this is all scholars who say that. But, you know, this is the corner from where I come. And it is pretty clear that by means of analysis of the language, of the vocabulary, you can say, you know, this is if this word is used by an author and in one portion of text and never used in the others. So that, yeah, you could still say, okay, that maybe he changed his mind or he gained new vocabulary. But the kind of, if there are too many differences, then you could fairly safely say, this is a different, also you look at the context that emerges behind the writings. So for example, in the pastoral letters, you have already like a church hierarchy emerging that you don't have in Paul. So this must be a later time or things like that. You can say, I mean, more simply, you can show that when you look at the picture that the Acts of Apostles show, compared to Paul. So there are dramatic differences in the way how Acts, that is written about 80. Paul writes in the 50s. He writes before the Jewish war. At his time, the Jerusalem temple is still standing. All the other writings of the New Testament are beyond that, later. So he is the earliest writer of the New Testament, earlier than the Gospels. Everything else is written after him and after the destruction of Jerusalem. After that, people had to readjust their theology. And then Acts shows that. Acts shows, for example, that, the main things are dramatically different. The way how Damascus is portrayed. And also, for example, Acts never mentions any Pauline letter. It never mentions that Paul wrote any letter. It doesn't mention the justification theology at all. And it makes Peter, from Galatians, you know that Peter and Paul had a major controversy about can we admit Gentiles to the table. In Acts, it is interestingly Peter who is the main protagonist of this table community, and Paul, in a way, is following suit then, but Peter is the protagonist of that. So, and Paul is somebody who is very much shaped to be a conservative and law-obedient Roman citizen.
In the book of Acts.
That is what we only get from Acts. Paul never mentions that he was a Roman citizen, never mentions that he kind of talks to Roman authorities all the time and that they save him from the Jews. And they are basically, his protectors. Now if you are reading critically, you say, okay, 80, the year of 80 or even 85, when Acts is written, it's a different time. At that point, Roman authorities are looking very critically of who are these people that are, coming together in the name of somebody we crucified, a kind of a rebel who we crucified. So are they maybe the same as those forces that went to war against us? Are they a revolutionary movement that tries to get rid of Roman, rule? So, and I think Acts tries to show a Paul who is not, dangerous to Rome. That's what Acts does. Paul himself had a quite different agenda. So, and I think he was much more Rome critical, and I think Acts tries to suppress that Paul was or could have been considered a very dangerous person to the Roman order. And the way it suppresses that shows that it might have been perceived that way, right? So that's a very interesting way to look at that. But that means that we accept that the Bible is a book that has many voices. And we try to listen to these voices and not to say one voice is wrong and the other is right. But we try to understand that even the pastoral letters, they are trying to do something similar. They try to make Paul less dangerous by saying, he was a good citizen and he was not an enemy of the emperor. And he also in the Pauline congregations, we had good old patriarchy so you don't need to worry about these things. Pauline communities are okay. You can let them live, right? So right. But this is a fascinating discourse where we also can understand, how much compromises are we, how radical are we? How much are we also making compromises? Because we make compromises all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying the pastoral letters are bad, but I am just saying we have to understand them as one voice, and that Paul's voice is different.
Yeah, this whole idea of compromise. And I can remember, you know, at one time in my Christian faith, compromise was a lot more about issues of personal morality and personal piety. For example, you know, steering clear of sexual temptation, this and that. And people like Bridget are helping me to understand there's much more of a systemic or structural compromise that Christians can make in this day and age. And probably most of our churches are guilty of that structural compromise, aligning ourselves with power and not seeking solidarity with the poor and the oppressed.
Right. Would it be fair to sum up Paul's, these authentic seven letters? The main difference between them and these other letters is that Paul is much more critical of the Roman Empire. Is that one way to sum up, you know, the difference in those letters?
Yes, this is an approach I personally think is very helpful, just to understand that Paul is not living in a political vacuum. So that was for me a very liberating thought when I understood, you know, this thing about faith and justification doesn't just happen in the church, and it doesn't just happen as my individual faith commitment, but it is something that is very intensely linked to context, to society, to where things are happening. And I think that justification theology is a theology that challenges the way how the Roman Empire functions, or how any empire functions. Which doesn't mean that it is not something about faith. It is, you know, it requires a lot of faith to challenge something like you know, all powerful Rome. But it has this dimension, and this dimension, interestingly, we can learn that Paul has this dimension from Acts, because Acts puts Paul into the Roman world. And now we have a lot of debate in theology that says, no, Paul had nothing to do with Rome. He was a theologian. You know, Rome didn't, and he didn't care about such, you know, worldly things like politics or so. But, you know, in antiquity, everything you say about God does have a political dimension. That's something I learned in East Germany, and something that I think was equally applicable to the Roman world as well.
Folks, thank you if you're just joining us now, you're listening to 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio, Render Unto Caesar, with your host Josh Campbell. We're just talking with Professor Bridget Call about her take on Apostle Paul and her recent book called Galatians Reimagined, and Reading with the Eyes of the Vanquished is the subtitle. And you're just joining us now. I've been having a fascinating conversation about one thing that really hit me that I just kind of mentioned was the whole idea of a personal piety, a personal faith, versus a commitment to structural and systemic change in society, and just where do Christians stand on that, and how in my faith journey, it was a lot more about the personal piety, and it's only recently, as I've begun to understand more scholarship, modern scholarship and biblical scholarship, that there reveals a much more challenging reading of Scripture, both in the eyes of Paul and Jesus, that show the basically the challenge that people of faith have to push back against structural oppression. And so, yeah, that's where we're at right now. I'm really finding this conversation fascinating. One thing I mentioned is, you know, growing up, I used to think that Romans 7, where Paul talked about his struggle, I do what I don't want to do, and that which I do, I don't want to, and what I want to do, I can't do. I used to think about that in terms of personal temptation, and now I think, well, maybe he was talking about the systemic privileges that a person like myself would have, and the temptation to create compromises instead of standing up. And I mean, as a white man, I think about the recent Black Lives Matters movement and the call to defund the police, and just how there's been lots of challenges in terms of, you know, I have certain friends and family members and close contacts who were represent some of these organizations like the police, and it just makes me question if I should say anything or get involved. And again, these are some of the compromises that I'm feeling more called out to address in my own faith journey. And so, like Bridget said, it does require that faith component. This isn't just it isn't like when you get this other understanding of the more public side of our faith commitment, it doesn't lessen the faith component. In fact, it probably increases the amount of faith required to make some of these stands. I can remember when the Colton Bushi case, the verdict came down and Gerald Stanley was acquitted of all charges. They had a rally and a protest and downtown, and we were walking and we stepped into, in case you're wondering, Colton Bushi was a young Indigenous man who was part of a group of young people that were trespassing on a farmer's field, farmer's property here in Saskatchewan, and the farmer ended up taking out a gun, and he ended up shooting one of the young men, Colton Bushi, in the back of the head, and got off and acquitted based on the fact that it was a hang fire and it was an accident. Yeah, and so anyways, there was an outcry for justice, and I remember one of these rallies I attended was actually, you know, we marched out into a main street in my city, and we formed a circle in one of the main intersections, and, you know, people were honking their horns and saying things, and I had my young kids there with me, and it really made me question, you know, that this takes faith, it takes guts, and in a sense, it's really, I felt like, you know, that's one example where maybe I have really been walking out my faith in more the way that Jesus and Paul intended. Thanks for listening, folks.